recent days. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, certainly a brisk wind. Whenever the sun goes in behind a cloud, you'll notice it has a bit of a chilly edge to it. Showers continuing across northwest Scotland particularly, and some more persistent rain coming in here later on in the day. Temperatures at best around about the mid-teens. Saturday night, it stays fairly breezy across northern parts of the UK, but that holds the temperatures up around 10 to 12 degrees. Come further south, though, central and southern parts of England and Wales having a chilly night under clear skies with lighter winds in rural parts down to perhaps 6 or 7 degrees. But Sunday, it's a fine day for England and Wales. Some high cloud making the sunshine rather hazy. Similar temperatures, I think, to those we're going to see during Saturday. Cloudier skies across Scotland and Northern Ireland. Perhaps some patchy light rain for Scotland at times as well, but generally dry for Northern Ireland. Going to next week, though, don't give up on summer because it looks like things will start to warm up again through the early and middle part of next week. We could well see temperatures in places getting back up to around the mid-20s. That's the forecast. Now back to Vaughan Savage.
Many thanks, Peter, leaving us with the good news. Now we conclude our book of the week, Neilson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter by Alan Shipton. By 1978, Harry Neilson, having found success in the music business, is beginning to lose his voice, and his health is in decline after years of drinking and drug-taking. He and his third wife, Una, have built a home in Bel Air and have a baby son. Harry still has projects on the go. Kerry Shale is the reader.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime.
During the spring of 1978, Neilson settled into a relatively stable life in Los Angeles. Mostly he was at home with Una and Beau, but from time to time, he would turn up out of the blue on a friend's doorstep and invite them to join him for a drink or dinner. Friends treated these invitations with caution. Jimmy Webb said, "It was fun. It's just that you never knew when you were going to be coming home when you left the house. That was the downside. You'd say, hi, honey, I'm going out with Harry, and my wife would go, oh, no, when are you coming home?" These outings were known among his friends as the Harry Ride. Much of the time from early 1978 onwards, Neilson regularly installed himself in the bar at the Bel Air Hotel, to the extent that he came to refer to it as his office. Neilson was frequently still holding court there late in the evening when the bar closed for the night, so he was given a set of keys to lock up after the staff had gone home. As 1979 dawned, he and Una finally moved into the newly built Neilson House. Their second son, Ben, was born there on June 2nd. Within a very short time of moving in, Neilson transferred much of his social life to the house. Against a stable domestic background, Neilson began work on a new album, Flash Harry. The recording sessions in December 1979 started at midday on the 11th and ran right through the night for several days. Neilson was drinking solidly right through the proceedings, and at one point he burned a hole in the pocket of his white suit with a cigarette. For reasons known only to the company, Mercury released the album solely in the United Kingdom and Japan, so it failed to get any exposure in the United States. Meanwhile, Popeye, a film by Robert Altman, offered Neilson the chance to do with his own music what Midnight Cowboy had done for Fred Neils. Just as Neilson was getting into his stride, his mother, Betty, died. She had been happily settled in the L.A. area, running a little antique store. They had been writing to each other regularly. In one of her last letters to Neilson, she wrote, "I can truthfully say that the only happiness I've ever had has been in knowing that I have good children who have been wonderfully kind to me and have loved me in spite of all my failings." Despite the extraordinary amount of effort that went into the movie, Popeye was a turkey. So Neilson had devoted much of 1979 and 1980 to making an album that nobody in America could hear and a movie that was heavily criticized for his score. In June, Neilson and Perry Botkin, his producer, went into the studio to make some demos for a proposed stage musical called Zapata. Botkin said,
"The drink had really finally taken its toll on his voice, and he was doing a lot of screaming. That was really all he could do. He went to a doctor's appointment, where the doctor said, 'Harry, if you don't sober up, you're going to die. Any moment.' He really laid into him. And he talked Harry into giving up booze. And then we did the demos for Zapata, and he sounded just like the old Harry.
However, at the end of the 3 months of sobriety, Nielsen began drinking again. The shooting of John Lennon on December 8, 1980, brought Nielsen's professional life to a complete stop. He took up the cause for control of handguns and espoused it with passion for the rest of his life. He told Derek Taylor that he had returned to a state of sobriety. He wrote,
"I've started the pretty again diet, 15 years of debauchery, and isn't it wonderful? My aim is to be as thin as a homeopathic soup made from a pigeon's shadow. I knew there were 2 10 o'clocks, but didn't realize how nice the early one is."
At the end of 1981, having worked tirelessly for a year for the campaign against handguns, Nielsen finally summoned up the nerve to write to Yoko Ono. In the letter, he said,
"Dear Bag of Laughs, now that we're both in our 40s, I guess it's okay to talk straight. I got to thinking about Nielsen's fourth law, which clearly states that the brighter the light, the more likely it is to be extinguished."
This highly personal letter, emphasizing Lennon's shining qualities, is a genuine insight into what drove Nielsen forward in his campaign. Journalists who expected the hellraiser of tabloid press fame were nonplussed to meet someone very earnest and focused who reeled off numerical statistics about gun ownership and the proliferation of weaponry in chilling detail. In 1983, he contributed 3 pieces to an album of songs by Yoko Ono, and in August 1984, he went to Australia to promote his single from that record. Nielsen settled into a waterfront luxury apartment in Sydney, and he not only undertook a punishing schedule of interviews, but he also threw himself into an energetic social whirl. By sheer chance, Jerry Beckley and his band America were on tour at the same time. Nielsen went along to the first concert, and after the show officially finished, he went on stage, sat down at the piano, and, to get across his anti-gun message, launched into a version of Give Peace a Chance, which got the entire audience singing. He also used the trip to buy some real estate, a piece of land in the Hunter Valley wine-growing area. Una observed,
"We would never use it, but it would grow in value. He had this idea of Australia as the next frontier."
Nielsen's family was now the bedrock of his existence. Building his house and spending time with his children were, along with the handgun crusade, the most important things in his life.
I like New York in June.
In 1984, to avoid the disruption of the LA Olympic Games, they moved to New York State. Soon after, the family went boating on Lake Champlain. Annie Nielsen, age 3, fell off the dock into the water, and Nielsen, fully dressed, jumped in to save her. In Annie's view, this was dramatic proof that his first thought was always for the children's well-being. As she grew up, Annie realized how strongly he was focused on his family. There was nevertheless one member of his family who provoked a very different set of reactions in Nielsen, and that was his son Zach, whom he had virtually abandoned when he split from Diane in 1972. Zach observed,
"He never fully got over the shame he felt for doing to me what in his mind was done to him as a child."
The following year, in between bouts of carousing, Nielsen's plans to form a movie production company came to fruition. Hawkeye Entertainment was incorporated on October 23, 1985. The financial manager was Cindy L. Sims, who exuded an air of confident control. By early 1991, Nielsen's weight, his drinking, and the years of cocaine had seriously taken their toll. Even after forsaking brandy for wine and reducing his habitual drug intake, the athletic man who had plucked Annie from a lake was gone for good. By April that year, Cindy Sims had systematically embezzled virtually all his money in a vain attempt to keep the movie business afloat.
We went to bed one night, a financially secure family of eight, and woke up the next morning with $300 in our checking account, wrote Nielsen. He filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In due course, court proceedings were brought against Sims, and she eventually served 2 years in jail for grand theft. But Nielsen was not without friends. Small gifts and loans eased the passing days, as Nielsen and Una anxiously looked for somewhere else to live. In the end, Ringo Starr bought a modest house for them. He also loaned the family $25,000 in ready cash. Meanwhile, Yoko Ono sent a sizable check to provide what she called seed money for his next project. But it was Nielsen himself who had unwittingly provided financial security. Una Nielsen recalled, "It was Australia that saved us, because a little while later the land in Australia was sold, and that's what we lived on." The shock of sudden bankruptcy tipped Nielsen from indifferent health into becoming a seriously ill man. He became clinically depressed. But in the year 1991 to 92, he also suffered increasingly from restricted movement caused by neuropathy, developed a painful hiatus hernia, was diagnosed with blood clots on his legs, and more seriously, his lungs, as well as developing full-blown diabetes. He felt suicidal, at times just wanting to hide under the bed covers, hoping that somebody would cover one of his old songs. He was able to function only by taking heavy doses of the drug Prozac. On February 14th, Nielsen suffered a massive heart attack, and for the remaining 11 months of his life, he was a seriously sick man. Una Nielsen faced the future philosophically.
"I think we did know the end was coming, but we just decided to live every day as if we were going to live on together."
The dramatic transformation in his physical appearance was most shocking to his children. Annie Nielsen said,
"I was very scared. He had an oxygen tank in his room. His hair was getting gray. I really hid from him for the last few months. I couldn't handle watching him deteriorate."
In January 1994, Nielsen and Una met Jimmy Webb and his wife for dinner. Nielsen persuaded Webb to join him in his car afterward as the women made their way home. Webb recalled,
"We started to listen to Harry's songs, and we must have listened for a couple of hours. They were wry and tender and funny and vulnerable and sweet and sour at the same time. It got to the end, and it was silent in the car. He said, 'Well, that's my life's work. Thanks for listening.' And that's the last time I saw him."
On Saturday, January 15th, he told Una he felt unwell. She said,
"That Saturday night, there was a movie I wanted to see on TV, and we were in bed watching it. I said to Harry, 'Oh, I can't stay awake for the end of the movie. Good night.' And that's when he rolled over to say goodnight. He said, 'I want you to know I love you so much, so much.' And that was the last thing he ever said."
2 days after Nielsen's death, Los Angeles was struck by a massive earthquake. Nielsen's funeral took place against a backdrop of destruction on a vast scale, with estimated damage running into billions of dollars. Earth tremors could still be felt. More than one mourner at the graveside joked that the earthquake and its aftershocks were the consequence of Nielsen getting to heaven and finding the bars closed. Harry Nielsen packed as much into his 52 and a half years as most musicians could hope to manage in a far longer lifespan. He proved that he could live the rock and roll lifestyle and yet remain a private family man. By refusing to appear live, he also proved that it was possible to have a successful pop career on one's own terms and to leave a legacy that stands proudly as one of the most individual and creative collections of work in the second half of the 20th century.
I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you
The final episode of Nielsen, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter by Alan Shipton, was read by Kerry Shale, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. You can find out more about the author Alan Shipton's work on Nielsen on the Radio 4 blog, which you can get to by visiting bbc.co.uk/radio4. The shipping forecast awaits right after we hear Sailing By.